Einstein estimated that there are probably 100 million stars in our galaxy. Scientists, up to a couple of years ago, estimated that there are probably 100 million galaxies in the universe. That would make about 10 quadrillion stars. That's a lot of stars. Scientists today have upped that to about 10 octillion stars. A guy named Sir James Jeans estimated that there are probably as many stars in the universe as there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the whole world. It's a lot of stars. Where do they all come from? Who could be big enough to get it all started? Not only getting it all started, but how about putting it all together? How about the design in the universe? From the microcosm of the bacteriological world to the macrocosm of the infinity of space, there is fantastic design and order. Where did that design come from? Now, I as a Christian happen to feel that that intricate design speaks of a designer. And I believe that designer was God himself. Now, you don't have to believe that. These are just sort of, we're starting very simple and very, very basic here. And maybe not all that conclusive at this point. However, that is a significant question, I believe. Who designed it all? Who put it all together? People say, well, you don't have to believe in God. That's true. Maybe it just all happened by accident. And yet, that is quite an accident. If I showed you this watch, for example, and said, do you know where this watch came from? Now, this, you might find this hard to believe, but before you guys came in here, I was sort of walking around Hormel, just checking it out, coming in, getting ready to get set up. And outside of Hormel, I saw a little paper sack, and I looked in the paper sack, and inside the paper sack were all these little, tiny watch parts inside, little glittery things, little round things, little shiny silver deals. And I looked in the sack, and I said, this is incredible. What in the world, why should there be a paper sack outside of Hormel with all these watch parts in it? Apparently, a watch just fell apart, and there they all are inside the sack. And you might find this hard to believe, but before you came in, I just thought to myself, and the idea came to me. I don't know where, but the idea came. What if I don't know why I thought of this, but what if I just tied a little knot in the top of the sack, just twisted the top of it there, and just started shaking that baby up? And I did. I shook that baby up for about a minute. And you might find this hard to believe, but when I opened up that sack and looked inside of that paper sack, all the watch parts just zapped together by accident, and here's the watch. Isn't that great? Incredible, isn't it? You go, yeah, that's incredible. I do not believe that. Too much design for all these watch parts just to zap together by chance. If I say, see that piano over there? Nice piano, right? You know where that piano came from? Took a little trip about a month ago. I was over in Africa, and I was up in a tree, and as I was up in the tree, I saw this elephant running through the jungle. It had one white tusk and one black tusk. I saw another guy running through. He was carrying this giant harp. I knew they were going to collide. They were running so fast. They were into each other. Giant explosion. When I opened my eyes, and all the smoke cleared, all the black and white tusk parts sort of zapped together with the harp parts, and here's the piano. I shipped it back here to Forest Home because it's real cheap. You go, no way. Little piano maker made the piano, too much design just for the piano parts to zap together. Little watchmaker made the watch, too much design, too intricate. And a giant world maker made the world, too intricate for it just to happen by chance. In my way of thinking, to believe the world just sort of zapped together by chance would be on the same level as believing that the Encyclopedia Britannica resulted from an explosion in a print shop, you know, and just all happened. No way. Too much design, okay? Now, so reason number one, a little basic, we could go into a lot of other things. Just gonna little tease you with that for just a little bit. God has revealed himself in the world, okay? Now, second reason why I believe in God. Okay, not only do I believe that God has revealed himself in the world, but I also believe that God has revealed himself in a book. And guess which book we're talking about? Jonathan, you know, you're right, the Bible. The Bible has been disputed for centuries. I think it was Voltaire who in about the late 17, early 1800s said, I predict that within 100 years, Christianity will be dead and the Bible will be no more. 100 years have come and gone. The Bible is still around. Voltaire is no more. And But whenever you deal with the Bible, there are just, I think, three basic questions you need to be ready to answer, okay? Just for fun here, let me try out a couple on. Just going to look, and I don't know any of you, so don't take this personal, okay? I'm look around for someone who maybe looks like they're a Christian, they're a Bible. Okay, let me, what is your name?
Ed.
Hi, Ed. I'm Ted. Good name. Hi. See, you have a Bible there. Is that your Bible? Do you read that? Are you a Christian?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Now, from this point on, Ed, I'm going to pretend that I'm a non-Christian, okay? And I want you to pretend you're a Christian. And now, just for fun, I've heard about this book. I've not really said it all that much. Could I just take a look at your, what would you call that?
Bible,
thank you. Okay, just going to sort of open it up here. Boy, you've got a lot of notes in here. Now, Ed, you believe this book?
Yes.
Okay. Now, my first question, I think, as I look at it, is like who wrote this? Before I've just opened it up here by chance too. What is this book? Lucky?
Luke.
I'm sorry, Luke. Okay.
Lucky Luke.
Now who wrote? Like I'm reading these words. Okay, just at that time, some Pharisees came up saying to him, "Go away and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you." This is a neat book, Ed. Who wrote those words? I'm not sure. I'm just Luke. These very words Luke wrote. Luke wrote in English.
No, it was in Hebrew.
Oh, I see. Luke wrote in Greek, and but these words are in English. Who wrote these English words? A translator. Now, wait a minute. Luke wrote these words, and then they got translated. Now, somebody translated from Luke's original piece of paper? That's a hard question. Here, thank you, Ed. Let me give this back. You see what we're getting at? How do I know, Ed, that this book hasn't been changed? I mean, a translator translated it, but did he work from Luke's original? The answer basically is no. Luke wrote his original, let's say, on a piece of parchment, and a little piece of, and he wrote in Greek. Okay, so here we have a little Greek, and then the piece of parchment begins to get old and crinkly, and all of a sudden, by the way, was Luke inspired when he wrote this, Christians? Yeah, wrote it down without error. Yeah, okay. Now, the piece of parchment gets old and crinkly. We need to, we can't photocopy it, contrary to the commercials we see on TV. And so someone has to come along and do what? Copy it. No photocopy machines. What do they have to do? Okay. Now, so they start to copy. Okay, copy. Now, were the copyists inspired? In other words, did they make any mistakes when they copied? How many of you say no? How many of you say yes? How many of you say, I don't know? How many of you say, I don't care? No. So Luke is, the copyist is copying. The answer is, yeah, there were some changes that came in. There were some mistakes, not big ones. No mistake that ever changes any major doctrine of Scripture. But some minor little changes, you know. Maybe in the original said, and the Lord Jesus Christ, and maybe the copyist just writes, and the Lord Jesus, okay? That's not a big problem. But it's an error. It's a change. So maybe he's writing along here and a little error slips in. Now, this piece of parchment is going to get old and crinkly. What do they have to do? Copy that. Oh. They're going to copy. It's going to come along. It's going to copy this. When it gets down to line 3, what's it going to do? Copy the error. Why? Doesn't know it's an error. So it copies that baby in there. Maybe makes one of his own. This piece of parchment gets old and crinkly. Copies comes along to copy that. He copies that error, gets down here, copies this error, and then maybe makes another one. What's the point? The point is the more copies you have, the more potential you have for error. So, can you see now why all these discoveries are happening around us? People are getting so excited about it because they're getting us closer and closer to the original, because the closer you get to the original, the fewer chances you have for error. Now, the point is this. How do we know these things haven't been changed? Well, we know that because we've got great copies. How good are the copies? Well, let me show you by comparison. We believe today that we know exactly what Plato and Aristotle wrote. Let me show you something that's very interesting. Here are some copies of some works, or examples of some works that are as old as the Bible, okay? Look at this. And again, no controversy about whether or not we have what these people wrote. Here's Herodotus wrote 450 B.C., okay? The earliest copy we have only gets us to 1,300 years after the original was written. In other words, there's a 1,300-year span from the original to the earliest copy we have, 1,300 years of potential errors. That's not real great. 8 copies of that. But everyone says we know what Herodotus wrote. Thucydides wrote around 420 B.C. Again, 1,300 years between his original and the earliest copy that we have of his work. That's not real close. 8 copies of that. Plato, a little better. 1,200 years between his original and the earliest copy. 7 copies of that. We'd like to have a real small number here. We'd like to get as close to the original as possible. We'd like to have a real big number here, because the more copies we have, then we can compare them and get even more accurate. Aristotle, 1,400 years between his original and the earliest copy of Aristotle. And yet, we say we know what Aristotle wrote. Only 5 copies of that. Caesar, 1,000 years. Now it's getting better. 1,000 years from his original to the earliest copy. 10 copies of that. Pliny the Younger, a historian, wrote around 90 A.D., 750 years. This is getting better. 750 years from his original to the earliest copy we have of Pliny. Now, Tacitus, Roman historian, 1,000 years from his original to the earliest copy of him, and only 1 copy of that. And yet we use Tacitus all the time in our history. Now watch this, New Testament. You know how many years from the original to the earliest copy of the entire New Testament? 250 to 300 years. You know how many copies we have? 5,000 copies. That's in Greek. That's in the original language. There are another 8,000 copies in Latin, another 1,000 copies in other languages, total of about 14,000 copies. We've got great copies. So I said, Ed, all right, apparently you've got some pretty good evidence that things have not been changed. At least we can get awfully close and put some faith in this book called Luke. But the next question that I ask is this: how do I know that Luke really wrote the truth? Granted, what I read there in this book is probably what Luke wrote, but how do I know Luke didn't write down just some legends he heard? Good question. How do we know that? For 2 reasons. Number 1, Luke wrote too quickly after Jesus died for these things to have all been legends. What if I were to write a book today claiming that John F. Kennedy made a statement that he was the Son of God and did miracles, raised the dead? Would I get very far? No way. Too little time has elapsed between the death of John F. Kennedy and my book. Too many people alive would say, no way, that never happened. And Luke, by the way, there is no New Testament book written after A.D. 80. Jesus died around A.D. 30 to 33, around in there. That means people were still alive. The eyewitnesses were still there. They would never have let a legend like that get started and written down if it never happened. And the other avenue of confirmation here is by archaeology. Archaeology used to be the one area that tried to say that the Bible was totally in error. They used to say, for example, that Abraham could not have gone down into Egypt with all of his camels back in Genesis chapter 12, verse 16. And then all of a sudden, in about 1850, they were digging around Egypt. They uncovered a rope made of camel's hair. And when they dated it, they suddenly discovered that it was about 2,000 years old. Actually, about 4,000 years old. They dated it to 2,000 B.C., just the year that Abraham went down into Egypt. They also found a little piece of pottery, which they dated to the year 2,500 B.C., 500 years before Abraham went down there. On the piece of pottery was a neat little drawing of an animal. It had this funny hump on its back. And they said, gosh, I guess that verse is okay now. We'll allow that Abraham went down in Egypt and took his camels with him. That's okay. I guess there were camels in that part of the land. But they said, you still can't get away from this one error in the Bible, the biggest one of all. And that's in the book of Daniel, where it says that Belshazzar was the ruler of Babylon. They would say, we have no evidence of anybody named Belshazzar that lived in Babylon. In fact, they said, we know who was the ruler of Babylon during the time the Bible says Belshazzar was. A guy named Nabonidus. And then, around 1925, they were digging around Babylon. They uncovered a cornerstone with this Babylonian cuneiform. They began translating it. And it translated this way, quote, may I, Nabonidus, ruler of Babylon, and they got that far and got really excited because they said, this is the ultimate proof. We're going to put the Bible down, finally, for good. May I, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, ruler of Babylon, not sin against thee, God, and may reverence for thee dwell in the heart of Belshazzar, my firstborn favorite son. And as they began translating more and put the whole story together, they discovered that Nabonidus was indeed the, quote, ruler of Babylon. But he was a kind-hearted sort of ruler who didn't really like ruling Babylon. He liked to go out and hunt, fish, make wars, kill people. For years he would go out and do this. And guess who he'd leave in charge of Babylon while he was away? His son, Belshazzar. You'll find that in Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. We could go on, but I think that's enough just to show a bit about the fact that legends are being now confirmed by archaeology, a great help in showing that this book is really accurate. But now the ultimate question. We said that the three questions about the Bible were, number one, has it been changed? We looked at the copies. Number two, what about legends? And we looked at archaeology, and we looked at the fact that the time span is so brief. And number three, third question about the Bible, is it really inspired? Now, when it comes to talking about the inspiration of the Bible, we're really asking, is there something in this book that makes it stand out, makes it distinct, and shows us that it's really supernatural? Is there something supernatural about this book that we can't explain in natural terms? And I believe there is. There's one thing that the Bible contains that no other book of religion has. You know what it is? Sets it apart from the Quran of Islam. Sets it apart from the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Vedas of Hinduism. Sets it apart from the I Ching of Chinese culture. What makes this book that we would call the Bible so different from all these other books of religion? Why do we say that this is supernatural? Is there anything supernatural about it? I believe there is. Any guesses? Obviously, prophecy. Now, I used to study prophecy and never understood it. You know why? I never understood the flow of the Bible. Now, some of you are probably very young in the faith here. Some of you really young. Others of you are older in the faith and maybe have this whole thing together. But maybe this would be a good review for you also, because with your help, we're going to take about 2 minutes and go from Genesis to Revelation in about 2 minutes, okay? I might take a little longer. Okay, real fast here. Let's sort of map this thing out. Real quick here. We start way back in the beginning in Genesis with Adam and Eve, okay? Creation. You can all see this. Okay, Adam and Eve. They sinned, were thrown out of the garden, populated the earth. After a while, the people were very wicked again. God decided to judge the earth. How? Through a flood, okay? And who did he preserve through the flood? Okay, begin for Noah. Noah and his family repopulate the earth again. God chose one man to build his race through. And who is that? Abraham. Okay. After Abraham, we have who? His son, Isaac. Remember, Isaac was the one that Abraham took on top of Mount Moriah there to offer as a sacrifice. Isaac had a son. Who is that? Jacob. Okay. Jacob had a number of sons, had 12 of them. Okay. By the way, Jacob's name got changed to what? Israel. And his 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. Good. This is called draw through the Bible. Okay, 12 sons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And a few twins in there. Okay, let's put them back together. And famine in the land. They go south for food. Where do they go? Down to Egypt. Okay, down into Egypt. They were made slaves in Egypt. In Egypt, God chose this one man to rescue them and deliver them. Who's that? Moses. Okay. Big M for Moses. Moses takes them out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, okay? And then does he go straight to the Promised Land? Nope. They wander around for how long? 40 years. Okay, 10, 20, 30, 40. They wander around. Then does Moses take them into the promised land? Nope. Who does? Joshua. Remember, Moses dies. Joshua takes them into the promised land, and when they come back into the land, they cross the Jordan River. Okay. Then they're back in the land. They need some people to help make decisions for them, and they God appoints somewhat judges. Okay. And after a while, they don't like the judges anymore. They want someone with a little more class, and so God said, you don't really want them. They'll just draft your men into the army and charge you taxes. But they said, we want one anyway. And what was that? A king. Okay. So the first king was, okay, Saul. Saul was out fighting the Philistines one day, and a little shepherd boy came to help him out, who became the next king. That was David. And finally, David had a son who became the last major king of Israel. Okay, and that was Solomon. Now, okay, now we're going to move Solomon down here, down at the bottom here, so we can keep moving. Because here's where it gets very, very interesting. And from this point on, I really did not understand the history of the Old Testament. And now I know why, because it's not totally complicated, but there's this major split that takes place. Although Solomon started out his life in a tremendous fashion, he ended up his life horrible. The Bible tells us that he took 700 wives, plus 300 concubines, okay, 1,000 women. Now that was bad, but what was worse was they were foreign women who had foreign gods, and Solomon started building idols, altars, all over the land to these foreign gods. You think the true God was real happy with that? No. So he said, Solomon, when you die, the kingdom is going to be divided. And when Solomon died, and by the way, what major thing did Solomon accomplish during his lifetime? Built the temple, okay. All right. So when Solomon died, the kingdom was split in two. Remember, there are 12 tribes. 10 of them were in the north, and they separated off and kept the name Israel. The other two, down the south, took the name what? Judah, okay? And they were totally separate governments, just like North and South Korea, okay? Totally separate. They had their own kings up here, and they had their own kings down here. That's why I got always confused, because it talked about when so-and-so was a king of Israel, when someone else was a king of Judah, and I would get always confused. I was going, wait a minute, what's going on? Well, now here's what happened. Israel up here started sinning horribly. Sexual immorality, worshiping other gods, and God said, Israel, if you don't shape up, I'm going to send a nation called Assyria in to wipe you out. God began telling them this through some people called the prophets. And here where the prophets come in. They don't shape up. Guess what happens? A nation called Assyria comes in and wipes them out. He destroys them. By the way, you know what the capital of Assyria was? Nineveh. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, that's... Remember Jonah was so afraid of going there? Yeah, that's why. They were wiping everybody out. He didn't want to go to Nineveh. Okay. Now, down here, Judah, the southern brothers, saw what happened to the northern kingdom, and they got scared, and they cleaned up their act, and they lasted quite a while longer. Okay? But human nature took over again. They started sinning some more. God says, through the prophets, hey, if you don't shape up, I'm going to send a nation called Babylon down to wipe you out. They didn't shape up. Guess what happened? A nation called Babylon came down and captured Assyria, captured what Assyria had captured from Israel, comes down, destroys Jerusalem. People are lamenting over Jerusalem. That's why they wrote the book called Lamentations, okay? And in three successive deportations, carried the people away to Babylon. Now, over in Babylon, you have guys like Daniel and Ezekiel who are saying, Lord, let us come back. And finally, Babylon is destroyed by the Medes and the Persians, okay? We'll just call them the MPs. Okay? Then, after the Medes and the Persians, the next major world empire? Greece. Okay? Starring John Travolta. No. Then we have the last major world empire? Rome. And who's in control of Jerusalem during the time of Christ? Romans. Okay? So that gets us right down to the time of Christ. We'll just stop here. We've gone from Genesis to Jesus. And now, at this point, let me show you why I got so excited when I began studying prophecy. Let me show you basically three of the most famous prophecies from the Old Testament. I think seeing this, now they will take on a whole new perspective for you. Okay? Now, number one, the year is 700 B.C. Okay? A guy named Isaiah stands up and says, I predict that If you guys don't repent and turn back to God, number one, Judah will be conquered. Number two, we're going to be carried away to a foreign country. And number three, we're going to serve in a palace of a foreign king. And now it gets very specific. The nation that's going to do all of that is Babylon. He names the nation. 100 years later. Actually, I should have made this original mark back here. Let's say here 700 BC. Because right here at 600 BC is when it all happens. 100 years later, guess what happens? Babylon comes down and destroys them. They're carried away to a foreign country. They are destroyed. And the nation that did it all was Babylon. A threefold prophecy literally fulfilled. And you'll find that prophecy in Isaiah chapter 39, verses 5 through 7. Now, I'm going to start here, and I'm going to sort of play the part of a lawyer here and just try and build a case, okay? That's item number one. Now, number two. The year is 740 B.C., okay? 40 years earlier. Now, the same guy, Isaiah, makes a statement. He says, I predict that there's going to be a nation called Babylon that is going to be destroyed. It's going to be destroyed by some people called the Medes. It will never be inhabited again. What's left of the land will be inhabited by birds and wild animals and desert creatures. And no Arab will ever pitch his tent there. Sort of a strange prophecy. At this point, to say that Babylon was going to be destroyed by the Medes would be like me saying today that tomorrow New York is going to be destroyed by the Boy Scouts. You just go, no way, it cannot happen. And 200 years later, in 540 BC, Babylon gets destroyed. It has never been inhabited again. Can you go to Babylon today? Jump on a plane, go to the Babylonian airport? No. Be tough to land there. Number three, what's left there, by the way, I was taking an Arabic language course down at Cal State Fullerton. It was taught by a professor from Iraq, which is modern-day Babylon. I asked him about Babylon. You know what it is now? Hunting grounds. People come from miles around to hunt there. You know why? All sorts of desert creatures, owls, ostriches, hyenas, inhabit the land. And to this day, no Arab will pitch his tent there. You get an Arab guide to take you around Babylon during the day, you're fine. When the sun starts to set, he will excuse himself very quickly and say, excuse me, I must go. Why? Well, we just cannot stay within the confines of this place at dark. Well, why not? Well, he didn't really know. It's been tradition. But Isaiah predicted it way back in the year 740 B.C. A five-fold prophecy literally fulfilled. And you'll find that prophecy in Isaiah 13, verses 17 through 22.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape to side two.
Tyre is spelled T-Y-R-E, okay? Tyre was a seaport town. Let me give you a little basic map of the Middle East, okay? Okay. Very basic. Here's Israel here. Egypt down here. You have Turkey up here. And Mediterranean Sea. Shark. Okay. Now, okay, here's Jerusalem down here. Now, Tyre was a seaport town right up here, okay? By the way, a lot of action around Tyre today. It's in the news. Tyre and Sidon and all that stuff going on over in southern Lebanon. That's where it is. This is southern Lebanon. I should have really made it down a little bit closer to Israel, but a little island out here that will become very strategic. Okay, now, let me tell you the prophecy. The prophecy is found in Ezekiel chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. Now, the prophecy says this, Tyre, you wicked city. It was a seaport town, and it was a major crossroads because people wanted to trade with Egypt, a major empire down here. If they were coming from Babylon over here, rather than go back here, would come down right here. And then people coming from Turkey, Greece, Rome, rather than swim, would walk around here and come right through Tyre. Major crossroads of the Middle East. The prophecy said, Tyre, you become wicked. It was true. It was the sin capital of the Middle East. And he said, if you do not repent and turn back to God, number one, you will be destroyed. Now watch this. Not just by one nation, but by many nations. They will come upon you just like the waves beat upon your shore. One after the other after the other. Not only that, but you will be scraped clean like a bare rock. Now, no one has made a prediction like that. This is Ezekiel. He's back up in Babylon. He's making this prediction, and people are going, Ezekiel, come on, that's a little strange. And finally, Ezekiel said, what's left of you, Tyre, will be used for the drying of fishnets. Just a bizarre prediction. Now, witness the history of the city of Tyre right out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. When the Babylonians came down to wipe out Jerusalem, on their way down, they decided to wipe out the people of Tyre. So they did. People of Tyre are not thrilled about getting wiped out. So they move out to an island. Okay, they move out to this island out here because the survivors, and because they say maybe no one will bother us again. Okay? And they're right. For hundreds of years, no one bothers them. Then, Alexander the Great comes along. He's the great conqueror for the Greeks. He wants to go down here and attack Egypt. He does not have a navy. Okay, so he walks around, marches his men around here, comes into Tyre. He needs food and provisions, so he stops in, and he discovers that the Babylonians have beat him to it. There's no food there, there's no provisions, there's no people. He's a little disappointed. He's ready to move on, but then he looks out on the island and goes, oh, there they are. He sends a little messenger out in the boat to the island and demands that the people give him food and provisions. The people on the island get together and call a meeting. And at first they are really scared. They're going, hey, it's Alexander, give him anything he wants. He's conquering the world. A couple of smart alecks in the back row stood up and said, wait a minute. He might have a great army, but he has no navy. How can he get out here to the island to hurt us? If he makes his men swim, by the time they get out here, they'll be so tired and exhausted, they'll be easy prey. We just, you know, conk them on the head and they'll be as they crawl up on shore. No problem. And they convinced the rest of the people. And they told the messenger of Alexander the Great, no go. Hey, you don't say no to Alexander. The messenger rode back to Alexander, rode in the boat, not on a horse, got back to Alexander and said, hey, Alex, they said no. And Alexander, history tells us, got so mad, he commanded his men to pick up every bit of destroyed rubble that was left by the Babylonians when they first destroyed Tyre, and he commanded them to throw it at the island. There you go. That's a temper tantrum. Come on, grow up, Alexander. Well, he was pretty smart. They picked up every bit of destroyed building and began throwing at the island, and little by little, as they kept throwing bits of destroyed building into the water at the island, guess what happened? They built a bridge. It took a couple of years, and when it was finally completed, they marched out on that bridge and destroyed 10,000 of the people of Tyre in one day. Check out Ezekiel's prophecy. Tyre are going to be destroyed. Check. Not by one nation, but by many nations. Check. By the way, after this happened, then the Turks came along and also wiped out Tyre. So it just kept happening to them. Number three, what's left is going to be scraped clean. Check. Alexander's men scraped that baby clean. And four, what's left is going to be used for the drying of fishnets. You go to Tyre today, and you'll find it's right on that site that the fishermen of the land, of the area, will stretch out their nets and dry them. Why? There is not a stone on the site to get caught in their nets when they dry them. They love it. It's perfect. Ezekiel's fourfold prophecy literally fulfilled. Now you look at that, along with all the others of the Old Testament, and all of a sudden something clicks inside and you go, there's something supernatural going on here. Human beings can't make predictions with that kind of accuracy. Too much detail. Too much specificity. Too much pinpoint precision. And it's true. A guy named Peter Stoner wrote a book called Science Speaks. He asked the question, hey, let's see if men could have guessed these things. And in that book, which is a book basically written on around the science of probabilities, he said, what would be the odds of men guessing these things would happen with no God? They just sheer human guesswork. You know what he came up with? The odds of men guessing these things taking place, he picked these prophecies plus a couple of others. He said the odds of men guessing that these things could take place would be the equivalent of one chance that they'd be right in 4 quintillion. Now, just to show you the odds of that, let's say that I had my arms 10 silver dollars, okay? say, just my hand. 10 silver. I put a red mark on one of those silver dollars, and I got Ed up here, and I blindfolded him. I said, okay, Ed, I'm going to stand in front of you. I'm going to throw these silver dollars up in the air, and I want you to grab into the air and try and grab the one with the mark on it. Now, would that be pretty hard? Yeah, that's only one chance in 10. Now, let's say I got all of us around here. We all got our arms full of silver dollars. Let's say we had 100 of us. Each of us had 10 silver dollars. We threw our silver dollars up in the air. One of them had a mark on it. Is that fairly difficult to have him grab the one with a mark on it? Fairly difficult. That's only one chance in 1,000. One chance in 4 quintillion would be the equivalent of filling the entire state of Texas 8 feet deep with silver dollars, putting a mark on one of them, mixing them up, throwing them up in the air, and having Ed grab the one with the mark on it. People say, oh, it can happen. It can happen. Are you going to base your life on the fact that that could possibly happen? Are you going to base your eternal soul on the fact that that could possibly happen? Okay. Well, we'll leave that. God has revealed himself in the world. God has revealed himself in a book. And let me give you one last reason why I believe in God. I believe that God has revealed himself personally. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Usually when we talk about God being a personal God, what we talk about is that we've had a personal experience with God or a personal relationship with God. People talk about their relationship with God and all of a sudden they're talking about personal experience. Now that's okay. But personal experience is very, very difficult to verify. I could come in here with a fried egg on my head and try and convince you that my life was totally wiped out before I put this fried egg on my head. I mean, I was into drugs, I was an alcoholic, I've been divorced 5 different times, I could not keep my life together, and then someone told me, Ted, you fry an egg, put it on your head, and you walk around with this egg on your head, you will discover new purpose in life. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that I put that egg on my head. And when I did, I cannot explain it. It's going to seem ridiculous to you, I know. But I put that egg on my head, and from that day forward, my life has been weird. No, my life has been totally together. Now, I could do that, and you can't verify that. You don't know whether that happened. In fact, there are a couple of you I might actually convince. You're going to go home, cook an egg, put it on, you know. So experience is okay, all right? But it's not all that great because it's difficult to verify. Okay? Whenever we talk about God doing something personal, we also talk about miracles often, right? Now, miracles are also a little tough to verify. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Let's, just for example here, okay. You know all a miracle is? Let's say that here you and I are. We're in a box basically called, let's just call this the natural box, okay? Here we are inside this box. And everything inside this box is natural. There's nothing supernatural in the box. Everything in here is defined by space and time. What we see, what we taste, what we touch, okay? Now, you know what a miracle is? Now, all a miracle is something outside this box, let's say God, just injecting himself into this box for a second and then going back out again. And you have a miracle. All a miracle is something supernatural, just injecting himself into this world and going. When God does a miracle, he doesn't run rampant through the world just wrecking everything. He just injects himself, does his thing, goes back out. Now, we can't get outside this box, right? Well, we can. Take a revolver, put it to your head, pull the trigger, and you'll be instantly projected outside this box. All right? However, you can't get back in once you're out. Now, here we are in the box. We can't get out to see if there's anything supernatural out there. Well, if we can't get out, what's the next best thing for the supernatural being who's out there to come in and join us? And that's why I think the most secure argument in terms of God revealing himself personally would be the fact that he's revealed himself not just through experience and not just through miracles, but really through Jesus Christ. Now, whenever you talk about Jesus Christ, don't let people fool you. There are always people who will want to say, Peter Pan, Santa Claus, and Jesus Christ, all in the same breath. They are all just creations of our imaginations, and Jesus never really lived. People just made him up. Don't let people fool you with that argument. Let me give you 3 very important names. Just write them down, and just keep them logged in your brain. Okay? Pull them out every now and then if someone tries this on you. Just try out the name Tacitus, Josephus, and Thallus. These are non-Christian men who lived around the time of Christ, historians who all wrote about a man named Jesus, who they say actually lived. They did not believe he was the Son of God. But what we're talking about is the fact that there was a man named Jesus who actually lived in history, his historicity. Tacitus was a Roman historian. Cornelius Tacitus. Josephus was a Jewish historian, Flavius Josephus. And Thallus was a Samaritan-born historian. All in their records that we have today, talking about someone named Jesus, okay, who claimed to be the Christ, the Messiah. Speaking of his claims, that's the other issue that I think we need to deal with when you're talking about Christ. His claims. Don't let people try and fool you by saying, if Jesus Christ were to come alive today, he'd roll over in his grave if he realized what we'd done with his teachings. He just wanted to be a good teacher, talk about love, but if he found out that we made a god out of him, he'd die. He'd be so upset. No. Jesus claimed to be God. Some of the claims were very, very direct. For example, in Mark 14, verses 61 through 64, he is on trial. And the question is asked point blank by Caiaphas. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Living One, of the Blessed One, the Son of God? And Jesus answered, I am. That's a fairly direct claim. He's on trial. He also said in John 10, verses 30 through 33, I and the Father are one. He said, well, maybe he meant they were one in purpose. Why did the Jews pick up stones to stone him? Jesus asked them, why are you trying to do this? They said, because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God. They knew what he was talking about. There's some rather indirect claims to being God. For example, the paralytic in Luke 5 gets lowered into the room, and Jesus, instead of saying, I heal you, said, I, what? Forgive you. Your sins are forgiven. And the people went, you said a bad thing. What did I say? You said you forgave his sins. Why is that so bad? Only God can forgive sins. And I can picture Jesus thinking, you're getting the point, aren't you? See, an indirect way of claiming to be God. Now, he claimed to be God. When a person claims to be God, their claims are either true or they're good. Am I going too fast for you? If his claims are true, he's the Lord. This is simple. You guys have probably all heard this. If his claims are false, they could be false for one of two reasons. He's not really God, but he thinks he is. In which case, he's what? He's a lunatic. A guy who thinks he's God when he's not is crazy. Okay? Maybe he knows his claims are false, but he's telling people he's God anyway. In which case, he's what? A liar. You basically only have three options with Jesus Christ. No one in history has ever said that Jesus Christ was a liar. He created the world's most intense and profound system of morality. A liar? No one's ever called him a lunatic. They look through his life and they go, hey, lunatics don't function that way. He was too together in his head. The only other option, he's the Lord. Not just good teacher. That's not an option here. Not just prophet. That's not an option. Finally, we've talked about his historicity. We've talked about his life. And just in the time remaining, we talked about his historicity, we talked about his claims, and now finally, his life. He did the very things you would think a God would do if he became man. Okay? Now, the two major things I just want to address as we close this morning. Number one, he fulfilled an amazing amount of prophecy during his life. We talked about the fact there was one chance in four quintillion for five of those prophecies to come true from the Old Testament. I just want to show you something real quick here. This is just for free. Here are some of the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. Okay, for example, born of the seed of woman. Okay, they never usually talked about being born of the seed of woman. You're usually born of the seed of man. But here's a basic proto announcement of the fact he's going to be born of a woman rather than a man. the virgin birth, back in Genesis. And so here's the statement of the prophecy and then the fulfillment as it's stated as being fulfilled in the New Testament. Now just look at some of these prophecies. It's going to be the seed of Abraham, okay? Son of Isaac, son of Jacob, tribe of Judah. All these prophecies predicting what Messiah would have to be if he's really the Messiah. It's like an address. I live in one particular place, okay? It separates me from all the other people in the universe. Here is an address for Messiah. It separates him from everybody else. He has to fulfill all of these things. Family line of Jesse. House of David. Okay? In other words, if one of these things was not true of Jesus, he could not have been the Messiah. But all of them were fulfilled. Born of a virgin. Okay? Now that rules out quite a few people. Predicted in Isaiah 7:14, fulfilled. Born at Bethlehem. Okay? Couldn't be born at Nazareth. Couldn't be born in Jerusalem. Had to be born at Bethlehem. That was predicted back in the book of Micah in the Old Testament. Okay? The specific place where he's going to be born. That's incredible. By the way, that dispels the argument that Jesus went around deliberately fulfilling all these prophecies. He knew them all. He studied up, and he went around deliberately fulfilling them all. He has no control over where he's going to be born, obviously. Going to be a prophet. Did Jesus ever make a prediction? Okay. Deuteronomy 18:18 was predicted. Preceded by a messenger, predicted by Isaiah. Who was that? John the Baptist. Ministry to begin in Galilee. That's where Jesus began. Ministry of miracles. Did Jesus ever do a miracle? One or two. Psalms predicted he'd be a teacher of parables. He taught a few parables. Malachi predicted he was going to enter into the temple. Remember the first thing he did, the first Passover of his public ministry? Went right into the temple. Clear that baby out. Psalm 16 predicted he would rise from the dead. Psalm 41 predicted he'd be betrayed by a friend. By the way, Judas was the only disciple of the 12 who was from Judea. All the others were from Galilee. Zechariah 11, that he would be sold for 30 pieces of silver, not 29 and not 31, but for 30. That was predicted. Zechariah 11:12. Zechariah 11:13, the money would be thrown in God's house. What did Judas do with the money after he realized what he'd done? Went back to the temple, threw it down. Psalm 35:11 predicted he'd be accused by false witnesses. Isaiah 53:7, silent before his accusers. Isaiah 53:5, he'd be wounded and bruised. Isaiah 56, smitten and spat upon. They did all of that to Jesus as they were crucifying him. Psalm 22:7 and 8, he would be mocked. Psalm 22:16, watch this, his hands and feet would be pierced. When this psalm was written, they didn't kill people by piercing their hands and feet. They killed them by stoning them. Piercing of hands and feet is what? Crucifixion. That wasn't invented until the Romans came along. Isaiah 53, predicted he'd be crucified with thieves. That's like 700 years before Jesus was born, it was predicted he'd be crucified with thieves. Psalm 22, his garments would be parted and lots cast for them. That's 1,000 years before Jesus was born. Psalm 69:21, gall and vinegar would be offered to him. Psalm 22, his forsaken cry of, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Psalm 34, not a bone would be broken. They always broke the bones of those on the cross if they had a deadline to meet and needed the men to die quickly rather than the 2 or 3 days that normally it took to kill a man on the cross. And they came to the man on Jesus' right and broke his legs. They came to the man on Jesus' left and broke his legs so they could no longer push themselves up on the cross to get their breath and they would die within minutes of suffocation. And they came to Jesus to do that. They saw he was dead already. The captain of the guard thought to himself, well, he's already dead. Let's make an exception. Never dreaming that one exception had been predicted hundreds of years before. Zechariah 12:10, his side pierced. Amos 8:9, darkness over the land. Isaiah 53, even predicted he'd be buried in a rich man's tomb. If there's one chance in 4 quintillion to fulfill 4 or 5 of the prophecies from the Old Testament, what do you think the odds would be of any one man fulfilling all of these? And Jesus Christ fulfilled 66 major prophecies. I've just given you a score here. With 333 specific details, his fulfilled prophecy is significant in terms of defending Jesus Christ as being the Son of God. But there's the last major issue of the life of Christ. You know what it is, besides the fulfilled prophecy? It's finally his resurrection. He said, only one sign will I give this generation, and that's the sign of what? Jonah. Jonah was 3 days in the belly of the whale and then came back on land again, okay? Jesus said, I'm going to spend 3 days in the belly of the earth, and then I'm going to come back to land again. I'm going to be raised from the dead. Now, Jesus Christ, on the third day, was vacant. He was not in the tomb. He had vacated the tomb. Everyone agrees that the tomb was empty. Even his enemies agreed that the tomb was empty. The only question was, how did the tomb get empty? There are three different possibilities for explaining the empty tomb. You know what they are? They say, well, he didn't really rise from the grave. The tomb is empty because they went to the wrong tomb. If they'd gone to the right tomb, they would have found the body there. Unfortunately, according to that theory, all the women went to the wrong tomb. All the disciples went to the wrong tomb. The soldiers were guarding the wrong tomb. And if the Jews wanted to disprove this ugly rumor that Jesus rose from the grave, all they would have had to have done was what? Go to the right tomb and show them the body. That would have stopped the rumor real fast. Wrong address? Tough to believe. Well, they say, well, okay. The reason the body was gone was not because Jesus rose from the grave, but because the disciples, those crafty guys, stole the body. They waited for all the guards to fall asleep. Then they tiptoed in past the guards, rolled the stone back on silent rubber rollers so as not to wake up the guards, ran inside the tomb, unwrapped the grave clothes from the body, took the body out, rewrapped the grave clothes so it looked like the body is sort of vaporized through, took the body on their shoulders, tiptoed back outside, didn't wake up one guard, and then went out and buried the body somewhere where only they knew. And then went and gave their lives as martyrs for a stolen body, for a hoax. Tough to believe. Every one of the disciples died a martyr's death except for one. One of the James died a sword through his bowels. The other James, an arrow through his heart. Thaddeus was skinned alive. Thomas was hung on a cross and then endured the agony of having his arms and his legs ripped from his body. Peter is crucified. They started to crucify him right side up. But he said, wait a minute, I am not worthy to die in the same manner as my master. And they said, okay, Peter, and they turned him upside down and crucified him that way. The only one not to suffer a martyr's death was John, the beloved disciple. Except history and legend, all that we can put together about his life tells us that at least once and probably twice during his lifetime, he was dipped into a cauldron of boiling oil for his faith. All for a stolen body? Tough to believe. Something changed those guys who were cowering in their homes for fear of the Jews into men who went out and changed the world. Like the only answer to that kind of a change has to be they saw the risen Christ. But they say, okay, that's not a good reason. Maybe the tomb is empty for another reason. Not that Jesus rose from the grave. Maybe Jesus never really died on the cross. He only fainted. According to this theory, and this is a legitimate theory. There's a book out called The Passover Plot. According to this theory, Jesus passed out on the cross. They thought he was dead. They took him off the cross, put him in the tomb, put the stone in front of the tomb. The moisture in the tomb condensed on his forehead through the grave clothes. He revived, woke up, said, I'm in a tomb. I'm in grave clothes. Must get out of grave clothes. Got up, unwrapped the grave clothes from the inside out, which is a great trick. He's had a sword thrust in his side, spikes through both of his ankles, but now he has enough energy to walk to the stone that's been rolled into a V-shaped crevice in front of the tomb, and now single-handedly pushes the stone away and runs outside, either eludes the guards or beats them up, I'm not sure which, and then goes out and says, I'm alive, I've risen from the grave. You know, it would take more faith for me to believe one of those theories and to believe that Jesus did exactly what he said he was going to do, rise from the grave. And if he rose from the grave, he's God. And if he's God, everything he said is true. And if everything he said is true, then this is true, and that someday we're going to stand before him. And the issue is not going to be how many good things have you done compared to how many bad things. The issue is going to be, have you received me in your life as your Lord and Savior? Now, we've talked about an awful lot this morning, and you have hung in there super. We're in a hot room, and we've covered a lot of material. Let me try and put it all together for you now. If you were to take a vote and say, which of all these things is the best argument for why I believe in God? And I've given you basically three main reasons, but a lot of little arguments in there. Which would be the five best arguments for defending your belief in God? Well, let me show you what they are from a theoretical perspective, simply from an argumentative perspective. At the bottom of the list, I'll give you the top five. At the bottom of the list is experience. Experience is okay, but you just can't verify it. A little bit better than experience is science, as you look around this world and say, hey, where did it all come from? Again, this is all from a strictly theoretical perspective. A little better than that is miracles. The fact that there are things that take place that cannot be explained in terms of our natural phenomena. A little better than that, in number two place, is the life of Jesus Christ, his fulfilled prophecies, his resurrection. You know what the best argument is from a theoretical perspective? Prophecy. Because it's so verifiable. Okay? Now that's from a theoretical perspective. From a practical perspective, guess which one is best? Isn't that funny? Why? Because we're human. And because we are human, we are always drawn to the experiences of other people. And that's why we need to know and love and have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Because as we share with people, arguments are fine. But ultimately, we're going to be sharing from our life and what Jesus Christ really means to us. Why do I believe in God? I believe in Him for three reasons. I believe He has revealed Himself in the world. He has revealed Himself in a book. He's revealed Himself personally, especially through Jesus Christ.